This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's from Chris Owens from UCSF. Many trials in peripheral vascular disease and more underway. What are we learning? Chris.
Thanks, Mike. This is always my favorite academic week because we get to meet the our visiting professor, all my friends from out of town, and then, of course, all my friends from here in San Francisco. So this is what I've been charged with this morning, many trials in PVD, more underway, what have we learned? So let's get on with it. Once in a while, the New York Times publishes a figure that is just kind of intriguing, and this is this is no exception. I think this is a little bit heuristic for a number of reasons. One, it starts around 1960, and of course that's when the large epidemiologic Framingham trial came out with its first results, which started in 1948. In addition, look at the curve. It just goes pretty much straight down. We could probably divide it into an era of antihypertensives, maybe an era of anti-lipid therapy. Really, there's no perceptible change in the slope of that curve. Even after the advent of the simvastatin study came out, the Scandinavian simvastatin study, or the advent of HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, great decrease in cardiovascular mortality. This is largely a result of, you know, very well-controlled, placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trials and epidemiological studies. And you look at the cancer, which is sort of tailgated on to the whole cardiovascular risk, we're down to almost to the level of the same amount of deaths per cancer as per cardiovascular disease, and stroke is now 4 per 10,000 patients. So these are some of the trials that have really gotten some press this year, the past 12 months. We know that Simplicity 3, just recently you've probably gotten the emails from Medtronic, that has been stopped. One of the reasons that they're saying is maybe there was no sham control, unlike its predecessors, which showed a significant difference. There's other things, maybe the way they measured blood pressure. St. Jude and other device companies that were trying to pigtail on this to the Medtronic Simplicity trial, they've also stopped theirs. I'm not going to speak too much on the drug-coated balloons. I know Impact Deep has been suspended. We'll let Pat Garrity speculate on why that was, but you know, it's interesting that was despite a very positive single-center randomized controlled trial, which I'm sure is going to be highlighted today. But this space is still quite active. Covidien just acquired CV Ingenuity, which is down in Fremont, California. Bards has acquired Lutonix. There's a couple IDE trials are going to be reporting their 12-month results soon. Medtronic is going to announce their Impact SFA on Saturday. I'm hoping to have the results of that. I'm giving a talk on Saturday morning, so I'm hoping to share those results with you on Saturday morning, which will probably be the first time they're presented in the United States. Cook Advance 18PTX, they've had to go back to the drawing board for a couple reasons. The Coral trial, which is came out this year again, is congruent with Astral and Star. Jade Hiramo is going to speculate on that and tell us a little bit more about that, I think, tomorrow. And then Crest 2 should be forthcoming, and you know, that's a $24 million trial. So quite a bit. I'm going to really talk about three things today. I'm going to talk about balloons, stents, and covered stents. So let's talk a little bit about balloons. You know, we're trying to innovate the balloons, and there's a little bit of a revival. I think that's probably coming from a drug-coated balloon. And in the sense of not leaving anything behind, not burning any bridges, trying to keep the vessel in its native state. And if you can imagine, you can continue with future interventions. You try not to burn any bridges, and this is just sort of a timeline that you can kind of see. But here in the end, a lot of patients we've been treating, we're treating more reinterventions now. There's this so-called epidemic of restenosis. So, drug-coated balloon, I'm not going to speak too much about it because I know Dr. Garrity has been really charged with this, but the components and the function, I just want to go through it quickly, is really the balloon is a platform for delivering the anti-proliferative agent. You have the anti-proliferative drug right now that's all been paclitaxel. There's no reason it couldn't be something else, however. There's an excipient to the balloon, which controls the retention and the release of the drug. But probably one of the most important features, and maybe not talked about a lot, is the manufacturing. And I think we're going to see four or five available choices in drug-coated balloons in the United States, many more in Europe. And one of the big pieces that will help us choose between the different competitors is maybe the manufacturing, the coating technology, and which one allows the most uniform and the best release into the blood vessel. There's primarily two agents, like I said, and we wrote these CME questions, and I put this slide on there only because for some reason I thought I was talking about drug-coated balloons, but I wasn't. And I just want to go over this because this is the answer to the question. The paclitaxel is a cytotoxic agent that really fixes the spindle cell apparatus in its completed state, as opposed to colchicine, which does not allow it to form. They both work on the spindle apparatus. This, of course, causes apoptosis, and the cell can't survive in this. Whereas rapamycin is a cytostatic agent that's an intermediary to growth factors like stromal-derived growth factor or platelet-derived growth factor. The balloon must come in contact with the surface of the blood vessel, and that's one of the limitations because there's more and more talk about the preparation of a blood vessel for a drug-coated balloon. There can't be any irregularities. It's got to be a homogeneous surface in the balloon in order to deliver its payload into the blood vessel, must actually come in contact with it. And you can see that there's a concentration gradient where most of the paclitaxel is distributed along the intima and intermedia, and then there's a decrease as you go out into the outer media and adventitia. So how do you prepare a blood vessel that's sort of optimal PTA, and this is where we're going to really start, is that what you want to do is you want to create a blood vessel that's able to take up the drug in a uniform fashion across all layers of the vessel wall. You want to avoid so-called severe dissections. Try to cross the CTOs intraluminally. We know we can all get across these long CTOs. That's not a problem anymore for us. But style counts, I believe, and more as the experience with drug-coated balloons gets greater, we see that the way you cross the lesion is almost as important as just being able to cross it. And I think intraluminal crossing is paramount when thinking about doing stent-less-based therapy. So some people do pedoaxis to cross it intraluminally. Some people just turn off the C-arm or turn off the X-ray machine, bring out the ultrasound, and cross it with an ultrasound because you can actually see it in three dimensions there. Trying to avoid reentry devices, perhaps atherectomy has a role to remove calcium, this so-called shave and pave. I'm not going to talk about the atherectomy trials, but you can read about them. This is one balloon that's from I brought this up mainly because it's from Pleasanton, California. This is from a company called Trireme. It's the chocolate PTA balloon. It has this woven wire type configuration to allow various pillows to engage the blood vessel wall first and allow the plaque to distribute. I think it's interesting because the way it's designed perhaps has some advantages over a conventional balloon's design. The conventional balloon is mostly wrapped in a clockwise direction, and as the balloon engages the vessel wall, there can be shear and torque. And I was talking to Tim Shooter about this last night, actually, and it's really unclear whether that happens or not, or whether the balloon shaft twists. One or the other has to happen, but there is some shear force, and we all have to admit that the balloon results we have right now are not optimal. There's certainly, in my hands, there's enough dissections, and we want something that offers a better lumen gain with less dissections. So you can read about this, and you can see how a normal balloon looks in this configuration right here. Again, this is more of just going over the mechanisms of what plano balloon angioplasty is. You got the unfolding, shear force, and rapid unfolding results in dilation of path of least resistance. So you get the free wall dilating much more than a sort of a calcified wall. There was a registry. This was led by Jihad Mustafa from Michigan. You can see it's about 30 United States sites. They did a BTK. They did an ATK. The lesion length was respectable, I think. And this is their results. So you can see from how does this compare in terms of dissection rates, bailout stenting rates, no flow-limiting dissections. You know, I don't know if this works or not. It's another design. It's an engineering feat. The spiral wire may not be the optimal configuration. It may be better for a mesh. I'm not really sure, but these are the results they're reporting. I've tried to call Jihad. I didn't get a hold of him, but we can kind of stay tuned for that. Cordis is going to be distributing this balloon, so I think you're going to see a little bit more press with it. I've tried also to get a hold of Trireme Vascular. It says, thank you for being patient. I've been trying to get a hold of them for a couple months, and I've been patient. And I can tell you they have not changed their website from this right here. Let's talk about stents for just a little bit. These are the stents. You know most of these results. We've actually reported those in this conference several years. But one thing you got to consider is that stents do have a restenosis rate. That's pretty much dependent upon the lesion length. We know that longer lesions have higher restenosis, and there's a consequence to that. And the consequence is when you go back in to treat the restenosis, you have pretty dismal results. So if you have this so-called class 3 or long occlusive restenosis, you have about a 85% chance of having another occlusion in a year later, and depending on the restenosis. But the best, even the focal restenosis, gives you a 50% subsequent restenosis after balloon treatment a year later. There's other things we can do for sure. We can put covered stents in, but this is just to illustrate. Once you put a stent in, once it starts getting restenosis, it's a rather pernicious disease, right? Stent fracture is still a problem. We know that our newer class of stents are a little bit better, but it's something that you got to keep in mind, and particularly about which area you put the stents in. One of the more recent design is instead of the laser etched stent, which is most of them, this is a woven wire, a nitinol. It's got six braided wires that are woven together, and this just got FDA approval, I think, last week. This is a Supera stent, and you can see in testing it's much more resistant to fracture than its competitors. In addition, it has much more radial strength. Just by the configuration of those braided wires, it has a much more radial strength than these other nitinol stents here. This is how it looks. Like I said, it's just got an SFA indication on the 28th of March. So just I think that was just announced last week. This is the pivotal trial results. Again, it's a pretty complicated group of patients with 43% diabetics, renal insufficiency 10% nearly, and 38% were revascularization patients. The lesion length, again, was respectable, and severe calcification was 44, and 28% was moderate calcification. And that's the results, 78% with intention to treat. I think that's pretty respectable for this stent design here. So stay tuned. The target lesion revascular rate, TLR at 24 months, was 84%, which is really good in a 9-centimeter lesion that this was designed for. And we see a lot of follow-up between 12 months and 2 years. It just doesn't end. And maybe the slope of this curve right here is a little less than the slope of this curve. There's some other designs coming out. This is one from Gore. Herman Bond tells me that there's about 6 more patients that need to be enrolled in this trial before we get it. The trial's complete. It's a single wire, and it's connected by Gore-Tex, so it may be a little bit more flexible. So we'll wait the results for that trial. Covered stents, I want to talk just briefly about these. As you can see, this is a typical picture that Gore presents, and here is a subintimal plane, and you can see the stent within that plane, and you can understand why this is a problematic, having 2 layers of the vessel wall here. This is the only trial that I know that compares this the surface technology with non-coated surface technology. This is about 150 patients, and this is it. This is for all the propatin and for all the hoopla that we've heard about with this heparin bonded. This is the data that I can tell that really compares them head to head. These are the demographics from the from this Viastar data, which is just came out this year, and I think this trial is illustrated because what it does is it takes all the lessons we've learned from the old Viabond trials and also all the technology and engineering advances that Gore's made, and it kind of shows us what is possible with this stent. As you can see, pretty high chronic occlusions. The lesion length is definitely higher than most of the bare metal stent trials, and you get a 78 to 54% or 73 to 33% for these lesions greater than 20 centimeters. So definite maybe advantage here. There was an editorial. So this is just this is ABI findings from a clinical improvement standpoint. And then there's an editorial by Laird that I think is really on point. 12 patients were excluded from analysis because of protocol deviations. Well, that's a little concerning. The primary outcome at 12 months on intention to treat was not statistically different from the per protocol, but nevertheless, this is how most of these trials should be presented. And then the patency of Viabond is independent of lesion length, but there were more occlusions. There are more consequences with occlusions or thrombosis of the Viabond stent. This is a trial that we've seen many, many times. It's probably been presented at 250 podiums or so in over 50 countries. And you can see this is a Zilver PTX on this curve here, and this is plain old balloon angioplasty. This, of course, represents acute failure of the balloon angioplasty, but how do you measure drug effect? And the only way I can figure it out is by the slope of this trial right here, or the slope of this curve. And if you take this curve right here and superpose it on this curve, they're almost identical. So it's hard to really figure what the actual effect of the drug is from these two curves. Certainly, what the patient cares about is actually clinical improvement. And if you look at the balloon angioplasty from the control group and the Zilver PTX from the treatment group on data submitted to the FDA, you look at 12-month clinical success, 57 versus 54, clinical improvement, 77 versus 76, ABI, speed, whatever you look at, there's really not that much difference. Therefore, the results of this are truly different from patency to what the actual patient experiences. And I think a trial that's going to address an endpoint issue is this BEST CLI trial, which you'll hear about, which the authors are Matt Menard, Alec Farber, and Ken Rosenfeld. The primary endpoint is going to be major adverse limb event, so it's a clinical endpoint important to the patient, not so much a patency endpoint. And I think this is what we're going to start seeing from some of these trials. So what have we learned? Well, I think we need to reevaluate what we do in the clinic every time, whether it's a stent or a balloon. Redesign most of the impact and most of the improvement we made in the past 20 or past 12 months has been engineering. It's not been biology. It's been engineering and design issues on stents and balloons. Reassess our trial endpoints and repeat our trials with those types of endpoints. Certainly, we need more and more research to avoid issues like Simplicity 3 or some of the other drug-coated technologies that have not borne out. And then reassert ourselves as vascular surgeons as leadership roles in some of these clinical trials. I think Peter Schneider has done a very commendable job and doing that. He's certainly PI on some of these recent trials, and we all need to do a better job with that right there. So thank you very much, and happy to kick this off.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.